This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Ever try to set up microphones in a criminal court? In the Bronx, it takes a court order.
You know, I think it rained the first day of the trial, too.
And we got one. We've got the courtroom wired. We will hear everything.
Come to order. Continued hearing. All parties are present. Recalling number one, continued hearing. People of the State of New York versus Calvin Buari. Appearances as previously noted. Minutes is present.
Calvin Buari is in court today to appeal his life sentence. Cal is 46 years old. He's muscular, clean-shaven. He wears a crocheted cap, a crown, to honor his African roots and to hide his receding hairline. Oddly, he seems almost relaxed today. Cal has been a ward of the New York State Department of Corrections for more than two decades, convicted of a double homicide.
My name is Calvin Buari.
Spell your last name.
B-U-A-R-I.
Long ago, Calvin Buari made headlines in New York City. Back then, he seemed to be one of the most dangerous and flamboyant crack dealers in all the five boroughs, ruining neighborhoods while wearing mink. He was, according to those headlines, a master of violence. Reports claim to use not only automatic weapons, but black magic. Calvin says they got it wrong. He did deal drugs, but he's not a murderer. Still, he's been locked away. No one in authority will believe he's innocent.
All right, before I begin my decision, I just want to make sure the audience is aware there is to be no outbursts or instantaneous whatever in this courtroom. Does everyone understand?
Yes. Today is the day Calvin's been waiting for, his last shot. Even if he wins, Cal will face other barriers to freedom. But if he loses today, he will, in all likelihood, die in prison. His future depends on the next few minutes, on whether a state Supreme Court judge rules in his favor.
The people consented to a hearing, and said hearing was held before this court on March 27, 2017. The case is on today for the court's ruling, and my statements will be brief because a written full decision will follow.
That's the sound of Cal's handcuffs being removed. He takes his place next to his lawyers. He stares at the judge and waits. This reckoning has been 22 years in the making. The judge addresses an almost empty courtroom. There's no jury for an appeal. I'm a journalist, and I'm the only person seated on the hard bench of the jury box. I've spent 7 years following Cal's story, 7 years despite my best instincts and my best interests. I know all about the love story at its center, and the turncoat and the betrayal and the perjury. I know that someone else confessed to the murders, and that the justice system would not let that confession stand. I know that new eyewitnesses have come forward. I was the first to interview them. And I know that people have died waiting for this moment to come. I even know who committed these murders. At least I think I do. As for the outcome of today's appeal, in due time. First, join me in the jury box. I'll explain it all. Yeah. This is Empire on Blood, a story of murder, betrayal, and a man who fought the law for two decades. And also of an obsession. My obsession with one murder case. I'm Steve Fishman. One evening in 2011, I got a collect call from a New York State correctional facility. I was at home. The call came from a prison payphone. At the time, I was a magazine journalist. I'd written about criminals. I'd sat down with the infamous serial killer, Son of Sam. I'd chatted with inmate Bernie Madoff. And I'd covered a wrongful conviction or two. Because of that, prisoners sometimes sent me long handwritten letters accompanied by thick envelopes. They were stuffed with documents. The inmates all claimed to be innocent, framed. They wanted me to write about the injustice visited on them. I skimmed the letters and I put them aside. They might be worthy, they might be true, but I didn't have the time. Their stories were complicated, and well, every prisoner is innocent, right? But something was different about Cal. Someone I knew, a former prisoner, one who'd been exonerated, had sent Cal my way and vouched for him. He gave Cal my phone number. I didn't record that first conversation, but I remember it vividly. Cal raced through the evidence of what he said was his innocence, as if he were up against a stopwatch, worried I'd lose interest. I found myself thinking, what if Cal is innocent? What would it be like to have the system against you and to have to run a campaign for your freedom from a prison payphone? I can imagine feeling completely helpless. Can't you? I told him I'd look at the transcript of his 1995 trial. And then it arrived, all 1,384 pages of it. I come from a completely different world than Cal, but I too lived in New York City in the early 90s, Cal's heyday. Reading that transcript, I realized I knew nothing about the world Cal lived in or the justice system that pursued him. That transcript was like a record from a foreign country, another era. Here's the event that started Cal's life in prison. It's just after 9 at night on September 10, 1992. In the North Bronx, two brothers, Elijah and Salahuddin Harris, aged 31 and 26, park a white BMW on East 213th Street. It will rain later, but right now it's a warm, late summer night. The temperature is in the 70s. After parking, the two brothers get food to go from a local Jamaican restaurant, Frank's Soup Bowl. They decide to dine in their car. One drinks a Heineken, the other eats a sandwich. The car radio is playing, volume up. And then, at 9:35, gunshots. Someone opens fire from the sidewalk a few feet behind the BMW's passenger seat, spraying the car with 13 9mm bullets. The brothers' bodies jerk. They die instantly, a coroner will later report. Who shot the Harris brothers in cold blood? For years, prosecutors couldn't convict anyone of the crime. But then they finally got their man, at least the man they believe killed the brothers. And that brings us to Exhibit 1, Calvin Buwari. Back in the day, his day, the late 80s and early 90s, Cal was an innovator in the crack cocaine trade. He was also a fashion pioneer. His style became what citizens thought of when they thought of drug dealers raking in money.
I have many favorite outfits. There was a time when whatever I liked, I bought it. It was like I was just young, fresh, and flashy is what I called it. I had a couple mint coats.
What color?
I had a brown one. I also had the wheat color one, full-length one, and matching that.
Didn't that draw attention to you?
I think it did. Man, when you young and you don't know no better, you just want to feel like you're living a life. Like, art imitated life back then. Rappers looked up to the individuals that were in the street that were really living the life.
Cal loved to think about those days. I could hear it in his voice. He told me he loved to drive. Also, he loved the statement a car made, especially a BMW.
Black man's wish is what I called it. It was like, to get that was like a dream come true. You know, like, that was the part when you really thought you made it, you know, because it was something that you wasn't really accustomed to from a minority at that time. I had two.
He had two Beamers. Cal ran his business, lived and worked in the Bronx. His fortunes rose and then fell on one particular intersection, where East 213th Street meets Bronxwood Avenue. For Cal, this was the center of the universe, an intersection a local newspaper dubbed the Corner on Blood, a reference to the many murders in and around there in the early 90s. When talking about this place at this time, I'm also going to call it the Corner on Blood. That corner is an hour's ride by subway from the Empire State Building. It's perfectly situated for a crack dealer who wants to serve the locals and also the kids of doctors and lawyers from affluent Westchester County. They could zip down the Bronx River Parkway in Daddy's Mercedes, a trip of as little as 15 minutes. Back then, East 213 in Bronxwood was an open-air drug market, crowded with dealers. They worked shifts, yes, 8-hour shifts. On one corner was a Jamaican gang, the Violent Shower Posse. On another were Cal's associates. One of those who sold Cal's drugs was Jermaine Russell Loney. Back in the 90s, he was a teenager known as J-Mo. He's our first character witness.
How you been, man? I pictured you different.
Yeah, tell me, what did you picture me like?
I thought you was like, I don't know, like more like savvy.
I pictured J-Mo different too. From our phone conversations and his commanding tone, I expected someone physically imposing. But J-Mo is short and skinny. Apparently, I'm less savvy than expected, which I guess means I'm older, squarer, more serious looking. But according to J-Mo, I do have one redeeming quality.
Yeah, you do a good job of talking to, you know, to people of different backgrounds, you know what I mean? Like, yeah, sometimes I think I'm talking to the homie, you know what I mean?
Homie? Or homintoshin. J-Mo is talking about something that's probably obvious. I'm a white guy. I come from suburban New Jersey and have a college education. As a teenager, I earned my spending money cutting neighbors' lawns.
If I seen you half the shit I say to you, I might have not even said it that way. I probably would have, because, you know, my vernacular is official. So, yeah, there's words and, you know, phrases that I might not have chose off of looks.
Okay, but you better talk like you're natural.
Oh, no, it's too late now.
Yeah,
it's too late now. I ain't gonna change up now.
So, well, let's walk over and see a bar. We can get a beer.
J-Mo is a maintenance man now, but during 7 years in prison, he wrote a novel called With Friends Like These, Friends with a Z and These with a Z. J-Mo says his self-published book is a work of fiction. Still, it's set in the drug culture not far from East 213th. One of the characters is a dealer named Smooth. He bears a striking resemblance to Cal. J-Mo did do a lot of research.
Say it again.
Crack was sexy in the early 90s. I swear it was.
What does
that mean? She was awesome. I mean, power. The fucking power that came behind that. She was ridiculous. I'll never forget, boy. I'm blushing thinking about it. Even though I know that shit no good, but them were the good old days, man. 16 years old, do whatever the fuck you want to do.
The center of this sexy scene, Calvin Buwari. No mistaking, he was savvy and cunning and ruthless, at least about the money, which he stockpiled. Mink coats and matching mink hats. Expensive cars by Bavarian Motor Works. And the Italians. Gucci, Armani, Versace on his back, and a gold Rolex on his wrist. Cal was easy on the eyes, as they say, popular with the ladies, but men adored him too. Cal spoke softly. He whispered. You had to get close to hear him. J-Mo leaned in so as not to miss a word.
I don't know a lot of y'all even know this. Me and Calvin live together. So I know this man, like I said, damn near as a father figure or a big brother figure. You know what I mean? His accent spoke louder than words with me.
Was it fun to live under the same roof with Cal?
it was pretty much the same, you know? Like, it was, I was in a room with someone, he was with the roommate. It was amusing, though, to see his swag, though. That nigga's crazy. The nigga used to walk through the fucking, the nigga used to go to the living room with a fucking Fila slippers, with a Fila robe, with a Kango, all type of shit. I'm gonna, I never knew a man could dress like that. That nigga boy.
In J-Mo's telling, 90s thug life with Cal was awesome. Getting money fast and spending it just as fast. And that allowed someone like J-Mo to dream.
Yo, bro, Cal used to inspire me for the longest. I remember, I did a lot of things that I said I was going to do. Man, my dreams, he never doubted me.
Everything was connected to Cal. And then Cal started to attract attention, the wrong kind, from the cops. For them, Cal was a king too, or kingpin, as they say at the station. So dangerous that the cops spread a rumor in the press that Cal had supernatural powers. That was enough to upset J-Mo's mother, who'd been Cal's trusting landlady.
Because this is the guy that's been in my house for umpteen years, eating cookies and chilling and having fun, loving God, and the media is saying, 19-year-old drug big, no black magic. She's like, no, well, you can't live here. That's who you're supporting. And that's who I was supporting.
Now, before the media talked about Calvin Buari as if he were a voodoo prince, before the crack empire and the furs and the exotic cars, Cal was just another kid in a hurry. Good athlete, decent student, living with his mother in a nice neighborhood of immigrants, most of them Caribbean, blue-collar, church-going. Their Bronx was not the Bronx of overcrowded housing projects and boarded-up houses. Cal's neighborhood had two- or three-story homes, some with driveways. It was solid, lower-middle class, more a Caribbean version of Roseanne than The Wire. So Cal is a first-generation American, a striver who wants to be a success. Cal's father is African, from Ghana, though he departed before Cal really knew him. His mother is from Barbuda. She raised two sons by herself. She was quiet, religious, hardworking. As one friend of Cal's told me, her priorities were taking care of her sons and making sure that they had what they need as opposed to what they want. But her oldest son, Cal, he didn't only have needs, he had wants. Look around. How do you get respect in America? Cal answered.
Money to me is one of the things that I felt that was more powerful than anything. That was my power. Like, when I see so many people, how much they valued the dollar and how much they respected an individual that had money, I think that that's what kind of like showed me power more than anything.
It was Cal's godmother, a bishop in the local church, who taught him, if you look good, you feel good. And Cal, he wanted to look good, as shown on TV. He wanted Air Jordans, desperately. His mother couldn't afford a $100 pair of sneakers, but it was no secret who could. So Cal dropped out of 10th grade to do the hand-to-hand, as it's called. Selling crack cocaine in Harlem, he earned the cash to get his sneakers. It was a fateful purchase. Cal might be thinking small. I want some Jordans. But larger forces were in motion. Cal's desire for quick money, that plunged him into the middle of a culture war. And not just a war of ideas. One of Cal's favorite artists was Snoop Dogg, whose real name is also Calvin, by the way. Snoop's first album for Death Row Records dropped in 1993. It debuted at number one on the charts with songs like Serial Killer. What gun is all that we need to put you to rest? Put two slugs dead in your chest. Now you dead in the motherfucker creeping and sleeping 6 feet deep. Snoop's vernacular, put two slugs dead in your chest, it scared the bejesus out of a lot of people. Middle-class white people in particular. This is Hillary Clinton in a 1996 speech talking about criminal youth.
They are often the kinds of kids that are called super predators. No conscience, no empathy. We can talk about why they ended up that way, but first we have to bring them to heel. And the president is asking...
Bring them to heel? Of course, Cal was oblivious to national debates about super predators. What mattered to Cal? Success. And for Cal, success meant one thing. Get that money, kid.
I always looked and asked myself, Cal, what is your gift? Like, what are you good at doing? I think, like, that's why I think that I'll be so great for business is because I'm good at looking for a demand or something and trying to meet the supply for that demand. And I think that I get a great feeling of seeing things that other people don't. At the time, I was an individual that came from Harlem, that came up to the Bronx, where his dad at the time, they only sold marijuana and cocaine, and they weren't accustomed to the crack game. So at that time, it was a market for crack up there, and, you know, I was the individual that supplied that demand.
Cal says he purchased crack for $2 a vial in Harlem. Then he and his crew sold it in the Bronx.
And they started buying it for $10 up there.
So crack for Cal was a business opportunity. A profit of $8 a vial meant hundreds of dollars a day in his pocket. Later, he told me he understood that he was destroying a neighborhood, his neighborhood. He was appalled at some of the things he did. Appalled is Cal's word. But as I listen to him reminisce, well, I don't hear appalled. Cal reveled in his success.
Whenever they tried to do what I was doing, I was ahead of the curve. And if they sold $10 bottles, I might come back and sell two for fives. I might come back and I'll sell $3 bottles. And they couldn't really compete with me.
In the early 90s, Cal's on top of his game in the Bronx. Young, fresh, and flashy. Enter the prosecution.
And I liked that. I thought, this is the kind of man I want to be the father of my children. And Rudy is such a great dad. I wish all those
New York is about to get a new dad who's not fresh or flashy. He's about discipline.
Rudy Giuliani for mayor.
After the break, Rudy and Cal, not a love story. Stay with us.
Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's kazoo concert in Kansas City, go Kevin, or Becky's bachelorette bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
We're back with Empire on Blood. Let's return to the New York of the early 90s, Cal's New York.
We were under siege. We were going to lose the city of New York.
This is a defense attorney named Oscar Michelin. He grew up in the Bronx, not far from Cal's corner.
You couldn't walk in the city of New York. You couldn't go out to eat in the city of New York. Cops were telling you if you drove through Harlem at night, don't stop at the light. We're not going to write you a ticket if you're a citizen. Keep going, man. Don't worry about it. Do not stop. You're going to get carjacked. Delivery trucks had to add extra people on. They were getting carjacked while they were moving. It was insanity, and jurors were coming like, look at this, man.
In the early 90s, there was an average of 2,000 murders a year in New York. That's more than five every day. Back then, I lived in a tiny walk-up apartment in the West Village. My apartment was burglarized four or five times in a few years. The last time, the burglar bent back a metal gate, then climbed in the window. It must have taken hours. And for what? Everything had already been stolen.
We've got to change the rules on the drug dealers and the street criminals. If we keep going merrily along, this city's going down.
In 1993, New York elected a new mayor, Rudy Giuliani, the man with a plan. He was a tough-talking former U.S. attorney who vowed to take the city back from the criminals.
Ladies and gentlemen, the mayor of the city of New York, Rudolph W. Giuliani.
Giuliani was sworn in January of 1994. New Yorkers were ready for a prosecutor as mayor. And Giuliani got going. On his watch, violent crime did start to drop across New York. But there'd always be one exception. Giuliani later put it this way, quote, "If you were to take the Bronx out of the city statistics, then murder is down in the entire city." Wishful thinking, Rudy. Even big bad Giuliani couldn't wipe the Bronx off the map of New York City. But Calvin, well, maybe you could take Calvin Buari off that map. The rumors showed up first in the New York Daily News in 1995. Of Calvin Buari, quote, "They," that's a reference to the cops, "they say he's a smooth-talking 25-year-old drug dealer whom locals feared both for his violent nature and their strong belief that he used black magic," end quote. The cops told the media and the media told the public, Calvin Buari was some kind of witch doctor. Get him off the streets before he casts his spell again.
Hello?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you, Steve.
Cal had started calling me regularly from prison. After his first call in 2011, he sometimes phoned a few times a week, and I started recording our conversations. I have a library of them. They're chronicles of a journey we were taking together. But when I listen to those tapes, I hear something else, too. They're a chronicle of a relationship, one of the more complicated and compelling relationships I've ever had.
Were you able to get the last two messages that I sent you?
I didn't set out to be Cal's friend or to spend years trying to get to the bottom of his case. And still, I kept taking Cal's calls.
I want you to dig for a record, Steve, because there's a lot of things that just don't make no sense at all.
Right.
A lot of the stuff about I know black magic, all that was like a purpose more than just me.
Once Cal got revved up about his case, well, the talking points spilled out. Evidence disappeared, witnesses lied.
Whenever anybody said that Cal did something, they automatically believed that it was true.
Yeah. I heard it many times, and I learned to wait for him to wind down. But there were other kinds of calls.
Dial 3 now.
And I was just thinking about you, actually, because I just...
That's good. I'm going to live a long time.
How you doing?
I'm hanging. I'm all right. How you doing?
Cal chatted with me about life in prison.
It's like 30 degrees today, huh? The prison is heated, right?
It's heated, but no matter what, it's always like it's dry cold. Because I guess all of the steel that's around, it doesn't never get to the point where it's just all the way totally warm.
One day when I had a cold, he offered me his recipe for curing colds.
You know the little herbs, the herbs meant to lift it, like the little candy?
Yeah, I put
that in the ginger tea with some honey.
Ooh.
Cal's life was endlessly interesting to me. Our relationship was warm, friendly, lighthearted at times. We shared things. But there's something I should confess. I didn't always like Cal. I didn't dislike him. But I sometimes found him opaque, like he suddenly switched gears on me. Maybe it was me, but on important matters, he sometimes resorted to dull aphorisms. He talked about glasses half full and burning bridges and lights at ends of tunnels. Cal frustrated me at times. I mean, Cal, if what you're telling me is true, you must be furious. I didn't hear fury. Sometimes I didn't know if Cal was being entirely genuine with me. But one day Cal calls with his own thoughts about our friendship.
Sorry about that.
I caught you. Did I catch you at the wrong time, though?
Well, yeah, but I want to spend a few minutes with you.
with you. Tell me again what you were just saying about Lance.
No, I'm just saying it's so good to kind of like drop my guards with you and just be able to smile and laugh and be a little free and open, you know, and be able to finally talk.
Yeah.
That's just something not normal for me, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, I know that. I just can't wait to get in a situation where I'm around the people that truly, genuinely love me so I could just be me, truthfully, you know, and just be free, you know, and just smiling, just sitting down smiling and just having an open conversation and just, you know, it felt good to do that. That's what I just wanted to tell you.
I want to introduce you to someone else. A crucial character witness for Cal. My relationship with Cal began with this guy, a guy named Emel McDowell. Emel is a round, shaved-headed Brooklyn guy who was arrested for murder when he was 17 years old and an honors student. He was sentenced to 25 years to life and eventually engineered his own release. He met Cal in prison in 2007.
Yeah, I was teaching a legal research class in Auburn Correctional Facility. And Cal used to come down to Law Library.
Emel was the prison's self-taught legal scholar. Clients, that is, other inmates, sought him out for legal opinions. He helped them write appeals. Emel even got one client out of prison.
And so Cal's telling me this whole story based upon, you know, his emotions and his feelings.
And you're smiling now.
And, yeah, I'm smiling. Because in prison, honestly, everybody's innocent. Yeah. There's very few prisoners, even after conviction, that accept what they really did. I mean, you could have them on video, on a crystal clear video, which is high definition, and you could see their face looking up, you know, during the crime. And, but, you know, I didn't do it. So when I was told that, I smiled just like you saw me smile just now. And I was like, oh, okay. But there was some things that just didn't seem right about the trial when he's telling me. I'm just like, can I take your transcripts back?
I agreed with Emel. Cal's trial was strange. I'd read the transcript too.
By the time I met Cal, I had to read at least, and not only murders, but different trials, I would say at least 10 different sets from 10 different trials in New York City. So, you know, I had seen the practices and what would happen, but his case was something different.
Different, like really different.
Yeah. Yeah, it actually scared me when I read them because I remember I was still fighting a wrongful conviction myself. And though there was issues, my thing was, hold on, if this is satisfactory for a conviction, I might be in for an extremely long haul.
To understand Emel's fears, we need to better understand the circumstances that led to Cal's conviction for double homicide. The Harris brothers' case had been hanging around for 3 years by the time Cal's trial got underway, like it was waiting to be assigned to someone. Let's return to the night of September 10th, 1992, the night of the murders. Cold cases never start out cold, of course. They're tragedies plus time. The clock starts on this one in the North Bronx, a few feet from the corner on Blood. Elijah and Salhadine Harris make their fateful decision to stop for a bite. The brothers aren't connected to the drug scene. They've been arrested a few times for car theft. Neighborhood people are hanging around. The drug dealers have mostly finished their shifts. One sits on a crate in front of the Jamaican restaurant on the corner. That's Frank's Soup Bowl. A few kids shoot baskets at the hoop Cal installed on a phone pole near the parked BMW. A couple of teenage girls, one of them pregnant, chat on a stoop a few yards past the basketball hoop. After parking their car, the two brothers get food to go from Frank's Soup Bowl. As they leave, one of the brothers wisecracks in the direction of the drug dealers. Get that money, kid. Kid. Not exactly respectful. The brothers decide to dine in their car. Then they are executed. People witness the crime. But no one will cooperate with the government, not when the perpetrator could be passing you on the street every day. The case is another dot on a crime map dotted with unsolved murders. Then, 6 months later, a rival dealer is picked up on drug charges, a Jamaican who runs with the Shower Posse, Cal's competitors. This guy, he's going to be sent to prison, but wait. Maybe he can wrangle a deal, maybe even avoid jail. He tells the cops he saw the killing of the Harris brothers. Calvin Buari shot those boys. The cops march Cal off in handcuffs. Then, the witness meets an unfortunate end, as they say in the movies. He is murdered in Jamaica. And so once again, the case goes cold. 1, 2, 3 years go by. Cal is still technically under arrest, but he's out on bail and back at work, distributing crack. The case against him seems destined to go cold forever. But the detectives, they don't forget.
The simple fact is, we have to try to fight back. We just can't sit here and let this kind of carnage go on.
Then comes the summer of 1995. Violent crime is down in Mayor Giuliani's city, but not in Cal's neighborhood. In the span of 1 month, there are more than 8 shootings in and around the corner on Blood. Cal is shot and survives, but 5 others are killed. It's all over the news. A turf war has broken out for control of the drug trade. Word travels down the chain. The local precinct, the 47th, forms a task force. Its target? The cops say it openly, Calvin Buari. Then suddenly, 6 people, including 3 of Cal's drug dealers, march forward with one name on their lips. They say Cal murdered the Harris brothers. The motive for Cal to commit this double homicide is, well, it's hard to say. But remember, super predators, they don't need a motive. In the end, the jury had everything it needed in the case of the People versus Calvin Buari. Their verdict, guilty as charged. In 1995, a judge sentenced Cal to 2 terms of 25 years to life to run consecutively. And that was supposed to be the last any citizen ever heard of Calvin Buari. Except that, did I mention, Cal is relentless. It will take him 20 years, but Cal will find a champion on the outside, a lawyer.
There are tragic cases with these people who are falsely convicted and sent away for a long time. It always amazes me they come out and they say, oh, I'm not angry, I'm not embittered. They should be absolutely bloody furious.
Coming up, Cal's final character witness, attorney Myron Beldock for the defense. Stay with us. We're back with Empire on Blood.
20 years, man. Just been in here 20 years. And just saying it is like, wow. You know?
I'm visiting Cal at Greenhaven Correctional Facility, a fortress surrounded by a 30-foot-high cement wall.
I just know, and I just tell myself, this just can't be my destiny. You know, and I just keep my hope alive, you know, and I just keep moving forward, you know, and trying to fight my case. And I just believe that, you know, one day, man, the truth is going to come to the light.
What's the worst part of prison?
The worst part of prison, it's a lot of things. That's part bad with prison, just living in an inhumane environment as far as being caged in sometimes like a dog. Just it's like you can even imagine just putting your bed in your bathroom and then having your toilet right next to your bed and having everything else, you know, located in your bathroom. That's
one. For a moment, I hear despair in Cal's voice, but Cal, he won't let himself linger there. He will stay strong, positive.
I do not allow the confinement of prison to take away from my mind because my mind is free. And I could think about and look at other things outside of the walls instead of just looking at the bars that had me locked in.
But when I visit Cal, it seems only his mind will ever be free. Cal desperately needs an attorney, someone to believe that his dusty old case is worth yet another push, and for no money. In his flowery script, Cal has written letters to hundreds of lawyers, even gets a few on the phone. Typical response, "Wait, you were a drug dealer? All right, well, best of luck." Then, in 2015, Cal got the legendary Myron Beldock on the phone.
So you never give up.
That's kind of like the basic rule. You don't give up.
Myron is the attorney who spent a decade springing Hurricane Carter from prison and nearly bankrupting his firm in the process. He freed a bunch of wrongfully convicted prisoners. He represented one of the Central Park Five. His work helped end the death penalty in New York State. A newspaper once said, Myron Beldock championed seemingly lost criminal causes. Oh, and in his spare time, he's a jazz singer. On the phone with Myron, Cal had launched into his spiel. Myron interrupted with four words, "Cal, I believe you." Then Myron, champion of lost causes, signed up to represent him, pro bono. Just one worry. At the time they met, Myron was 85 years old and not doing well. Prostate cancer, heart problems, and a tumor behind his left eye. A short time after I visited Cal in prison, I stopped by Myron's office on Park Avenue. It's roomy with a jungly feel. There are lots of plants. But what rivets me is Myron's eye, the one with the tumor behind it. His head faces me, but the eye, it bulges and veers off at a 45-degree angle, like a wayward periscope. I try not to stare as we discuss Cal's case.
It kind of like gave me a kind of a shot of adrenaline. I was feeling very sick a couple of months ago, and I didn't think I would be able to take a case on like that. And right now, I'm very enervated by it.
He says enervated, meaning drained of energy, but I know he means energized, or maybe both. Myron believes Cal. Myron is a crusader for justice. Cal is his latest crusade. But for Cal, Myron isn't just a distant figure leading a crusade. Cal speaks of Myron so tenderly. To him, Myron's concern is personal, almost parental.
Said I called him one late night, I think it was after 8 o'clock, and he was sitting in the office working on my case. And he basically told me, "Calvin, let me get the work done because I want to make sure you're covered." Now, when he said that to me, I've never had any male figure that was older than me that basically made me feel as though they cared about me.
In Myron's office, though, I wasn't feeling particularly tender. I had a lingering problem with Cal's case, the same problem that every lawyer had had with Cal's case.
I mean, he's a drug dealer who helped bring crack to the Bronx and ruin people's lives. How should people think about that? And especially, how should they think about you trying to get a guy like that out of prison?
Well, there's no easy answer. People are entitled to their opinion, and lots of people think that people who have dealt in drugs heavily or really have been dealers and rather than users aren't entitled to any consideration. I don't feel that. I feel that there's probably explanations for what everybody does that are acceptable. I mean, that's how I feel.
Mm-hmm. And let people think what they want about you.
Well, I can't be helped.
Myron saves his anger for prosecutors he believes have done wrong. His sympathy, he saves that for inmates like Cal.
Their lives were stolen from them. Their quality of life was absolutely destroyed. You know, their youth generally was stolen from them, mm-hmm, by people who cheated them. And they cheated. That's the really the right word. They cheated. They didn't do careful work. They did sloppy work, and then they intentionally did wrong work. Most of
these cases. Do you think they intentionally did wrong work in the Calvin case?
Yes. Yes, from what I can see so far.
As we're talking, my cell phone rings. That annoying guitar strumming, that's my ring.
You know, this is Cal on the phone.
Huh.
Should we talk to him?
Sure.
Hello? Cal? Hello?
Hey, Steve. Hello, Steve. How you doing?
Good. This is going to be interesting for you, Cal. Guess who I'm here with? Myron Beldock sitting here in the flesh.
Calvin, it's your friendly neighborhood lawyer.
How you doing, Myron?
That's all right. We've been talking about life and times and working. I'm doing okay.
All right, that's good. That's definitely good.
So Myron Beldock is working days, evenings, weekends for Calvin Buari. According to Myron, you can't condemn a man for murder, even a crack dealer, if he didn't do the murder.
You there?
Steve, first... Hello? Yes, I'm here. First, you have to know that I'm going in to have my effing eye operation tomorrow, which is serious stuff. Buari knows about it. So I have to be optimistic, because if I don't survive, it's going to be a hell of a lot of problems for other people. But I had to finish this. I had to put a signature to the papers so that the work I've done, at least, is now boxed. This motion is his last chance, because you don't get back again. So anyhow, that's my thinking. Steve, I kind of have to go. I only have an hour and a half left in the office before I run off to have a little operation.
You're not going to die, right?
I don't intend to. You want to hear me sing the song?
Yeah.
I'm going to sing it to Cynthia. Are you ready, everybody? I'm angioma. I'm angioma. It's not a rumor. I caught a tumor. It keeps on growing. It's really showing. It wants to eat my eye. It makes me want to cry. But I'm no Mona. This carcinoma's got to go. My sense of humor can't push this bloomer out the door. Doc's going to operate. Hope that it's not too late. I'm angioma. I'm angioma no more. That's it. So, Steve, as you can see, I'm a person of goodwill and good sense.
Are you there, Cal?
Yes, I'm here, Steve. I might not can't stay on long. Is it true that Myron passed yesterday?
Yep, it's true. So I was trying to call you. Oh, God. What do you think, man?
Wow. Heart-wrenching.
Yeah. Heart-wrenching. Yeah. How did you hear the news?
I was just coming from Law Library today, and the guy just came and told me, said that he heard that Myron Beldock passed away.
Yeah.
And then Cal cuts out. I didn't know why, but it left me to think. In court, people talk of reasonable doubt. Reasonable doubt will set an accused man free. But life is not reasonable. The next day.
Are you there?
Yeah, I'm here, Steve. I'm not going to be that long, but I apologize for hanging up abruptly. I just got kind of like a little emotional, and I just couldn't think really answering them questions and stuff like that, man, because, you know, with Myron Beldock, you know, fighting my case, it just seemed like, you know, I really finally got the guy that I needed to really get to where I needed to be. Yeah. I'm kind of scared to tell you the truth, Steve.
Yeah.
I really felt a little secure with my life in his hand, so to speak.
Yeah.
Kind of really like a major blow.
Yeah. How was last night for you?
I mean, I just broke down, Steve, man. I just broke down, man. I'm just hard. I mean, like, outside of him being my lawyer, it's like I really liked him as a person, personally. You know, just, I wanted to really just get to know him. It's just so much more than just my case, you know. So it's kind of hard last night, you know. I broke down from the time that I hung up the phone on you, and I feel myself going through it again. It's great.
Oh, man. You're not gonna give up.
No.
This story isn't over yet. It's just getting started.
It sends a message in the street. Everybody was scared of Calvin. See, the Harris brothers had nothing to do with drugs. They had to do with cars. Their sin was insulting him in front of people.
I tracked down missing eyewitnesses with the help of a hard-drinking, Bible-toting private eye. I learn about courtroom deals that were struck, lies that were told, and the nightmares that ensued. I find out how a priest-like cop undid a confessed killer's confession. I go inside a meeting that never should have happened, when in a prison yard, Cal meets the snitch who put him there. And I'll take you to meet the person I think is the real killer. That's all coming up in future episodes of Empire on Blood. Yeah. Empire on Blood is produced by Emil Klein and Mia Lobel with Joelle Dusek. Our editor is Julia Barton. Original scoring by Joel St. Julian. Theme song by Mr. Len. Fact-checking by Stephanie Daniel. Special thanks to Jason Gambrell, Evan Viola, Christopher Landry, Rachel Strom, Nicole Bunces, Christy Mirabal, Kate Miscal, Lisa Firestein, Jacob Smith, Carly Migliori, and Andy Bowers at Panoply. I'm Steve Fishman. A kingdom built of blood leaves the king lonely. Bear the burdens of your sins and the holy. Beware the blurred line between friend and foe. The last words you hear.
It's time to go.